You're listening to E-Commerce Fastlane, the podcast show to help you build, manage, grow, and scale a successful and thriving company powered by Shopify. Listen to real conversations with partners and subject matter experts as they share proven practical strategies, platforms, and the best Shopify apps to help you accelerate your business. The time is now for you to improve efficiencies, grow revenue, profit, and lifetime customer loyalty. Please welcome your host, startup founder, and strategic advisor, Steve Hutt.
Well, welcome back to another episode of E-Commerce Fastlane. I'm your host, Steve Hutt. You know, thanks so much for joining me today. I know there's so many podcast choices out there in the in Shopify world and the direct-to-consumer world, logistics world, marketing, and I just appreciate your taking time today and listening to this episode. We're excited today. We're having Andrea, who is the Director of Logistics and Warehouse Operations at a company called Murad. Now, you may have heard of Murad. I mean, I think they launched way back in 1989, did a tiny bit of research kind of before recording today, and they really are kind of a pioneering kind of, I call them even like a clinical care company, and it was founded by Dr. Howard Murad. Really, it's so unique that I think I can remember back in the early 90s actually seeing these infomercials, and it seemed to me, and I'm sure we'll hear a little more about that later, but it seems to me that Dr. Murad was the first person that was kind of a public-facing figure who was a dermatologist that decided to build a brand and then publicly get on these infomercials and selling a lot. And then over the years, I think the brand has pivoted quite a bit over the years. I think eventually they got acquired by Unilever. It's such an interesting story. But more importantly, the reason why I have Andreas on today is because I believe that he has a skill set that is very, very unique. And I think those that are listening, if you're kind of in the mid-market right now and logistics and is important to you and the kind of the post-purchase kind of customer experience, this is your guy. He's been around the block. He's been with a lot of different brands along the way. Right now, he sits perfectly in the Murad brand right now. So, Andreas, welcome to E-Commerce Fastlane.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, we kind of chatted just before recording today, and like I said, you have quite a storied background. Can you talk a little bit first about how you got involved in logistics? You seem to kind of hop along through some really interesting brands along the way, sitting now with Murad. I'd just like to hear quickly that story leading up to where you are today.
Well, sure. Thanks for asking. As a lot of things in life, it was completely by accident.
Of course.
I went to Georgetown University and studied international politics with a concentration in Islam and Christianity. And then I got a job for a company who at the time, most people probably didn't know unless you worked in a engineer shop, but called McMaster Car Supply Company. And McMaster Car Supply Company, I like to tell people, was Amazon before Amazon, but for industrial supplies and a variety of different things. And they had 5 locations across the country. And if you were in their metro area, you got same day delivery. If you called early enough in the morning, if you were a little bit further out or called later in the afternoon, you got next day delivery. And probably most of the country got 2 to 3 day delivery for McMaster Car. So a lot of folks, about the time I started at McMaster Car in about 2004, this is when .com started getting even, buying online became even more popular. So McMaster Car was like an Amazon, but for B2B. But then the folks that worked for McMaster Car were very easily able to transfer the skills from a small order, small package B2B company to small order, small package B2C company. Because if you want, you didn't go to McMaster Car to buy 10,000 sprockets. You went to McMaster Car to buy 1 sprocket because your machine was down. Right. And you knew that if you called them at 5:30 in the morning when you realized your machine was down, you were going to have the sprocket by noon. And now a lot of people do that. In 2004, can you guess how many people did that in the United States? Almost no one, right?
None.
You'd have to run to go get it yourself from the store.
Right.
And maybe you couldn't do that. Maybe the Home Depot is not going to happen, right? It's not going to have it because what you need is very specifically just for your machine, and only McMaster Car is going to have it. So that was my introduction into warehousing, logistics, supply chain, and then the rest is history from there.
Well, that's cool. Actually, I'm on McMaster Car's website right now, and I can see it's so interesting how they pioneered that whole kind of, it's almost, it sounded like a little bit of like Prime-ish with.
It was, that's why I say it's Amazon before Amazon. That's why when Amazon came out, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I get this. This is what we did. I mean, the focus on the speed of the orders going through, if an order took more than 1 hour from placement to being on a truck, it was like a nightmare. It was a disaster. You thought the walls of the warehouse fell in, right? That was the amount of focus they had on that. And that's why so many McMaster Car alumni went to be very big names in logistics and e-commerce and startups, especially. They went to Rent the One Runway. I think the guy at Mason Hub was McMaster Car. All of these folks got very big in the world of e-commerce, much bigger than me. But I also profited from that experience.
That's lovely. What's interesting, I think, with your career is that you obviously have a lot of experience, kind of like the pre-COVID, the COVID times, and then I'm going to call it post-COVID. And so knowing that there's these three different kind of significant points, I would call them, kind of in just kind of the e-commerce journey. And so I would love to hear it from your perspective about how you've seen the logistics and kind of warehouse operations, how they have changed to kind of meet the growing demand of online shoppers, kind of pre-COVID and kind of post-COVID. Like, what have you seen in the space? And then how have you adapted kind of as a VP of the company?
Sure. So I am just the director, but thank you for the promotion.
You're hired.
Yeah. So hopefully that'll be coming soon.
Yeah.
But, you know, everybody loves promotion.
100%.
So my primary, the way I experienced COVID is primarily as the person at FabFitFun, mostly at FabFitFun, which if the folks, probably most of the folks on the call know what FabFitFun is, but it's basically the biggest, even was the biggest when subscription boxes were, you know, we're a huge fad. And now that they're not as much of a fad, is still the biggest subscription box company, I would imagine, if not one of the biggest.
Yeah.
So really was the biggest name to come out of that trend. And my experience with COVID and logistics was managing the parcel carrier relationships for FabFitFun. Yeah. And I was hired there as a senior transportation manager a couple of years before COVID. And to be totally honest, the job was needed there. They needed someone to think strategically about their transportation. But it was also a little sleepy in the sense that the job was primarily, for the most part, to manage the FedEx contract. And pre-COVID, you only really renegotiated your contracts 2 or 3 times. So my job would be basically once every year and a half, 2 years, negotiate that FedEx contract. And if I got a big savings, that savings would pay my salary for 100 years, right? So you didn't necessarily work on it all of the time. So that's why I say it was a little sleepy. But when you did do what you needed to do, you provided a massive savings that was a massive ROI that more than justified your job in spades. And then COVID happened. And obviously, managing that relationship was a lot more different because you had huge cost concerns and then you had huge service concerns. So I could tell you, Steve, and most of the other folks on the call who worked with parcel logistics will probably attest to this, that before COVID, you never had to really worry about what happened to your packages after FedEx picked them up. You never had to worry that if you misforecasted and you actually needed 2 trucks versus 1 truck. Okay, so the biggest problem was that you called them up and said you needed a 2nd truck, and maybe you didn't get it that day, but you definitely got it first thing in the morning. These things were not, you didn't think about it, right? Just like pre-COVID, you know, you went to the grocery store, you went to the store for toilet paper and you didn't have to think about whether the toilet paper was there, right? These are things you never had to think about. So the same thing happened with parcel logistics. So we saw coming that the parcel logistics world was going to change. So at FabFitFun, me and my boss, Julian Van Erlach, who is the VP there, the SVP, we worked together to implement a multi-carrier solution. And I've given talks about this at Parcel Forum, at Home Delivery World. The Wall Street Journal has asked me about kind of this journey of how we manage this as well. But at the time, pre-COVID, we were only with FedEx and we had an amazing rate with them that we were able to negotiate down. It was about $5 a package. And the FabFitFun box is like a large lady's boot box is the best way to think about it.
Right.
And this was nationwide, right? And we only fulfilled out of California. So that $5 box was basically my achievement, right? That's what paid my salary for 100 years, that one contract.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an amazing rate at the time. But we knew that times were changing. So we started to diversify our carrier network. And by the end of it, we had about 6 or 7 carriers. So in about 18 months, we went from 1 carrier to 6 to 7 carriers while COVID was exploding all over us.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing with COVID at the time is that it was probably I say, and I think I'm right in saying this, that it was probably the first time that every part of logistics, every single mode of logistics was under strain, probably since World War II. To think about how everything changed, the movement of everything changed, how hard it became, how difficult it became to manage the supply chains. I can't think of anything bigger than COVID since World War II. Because even today, we know we're having supply chain issues. We know the Houthis are attacking ships in the Red Sea, and that's causing problems. We know the Suez Canal is having problems.
Yeah.
You know, we know that potential. People are predicting more tariffs are going to come depending on how things are decided in November. That's going to cause things. But there are still elements of logistics that are not under strain, and they will continue to be, right? There's nothing in the next 3 months that is going to cause a surge of e-commerce like we had during COVID, unless we have another COVID, right? Which probably won't happen. So that'll be fine. So you've always had strains in logistics, but never everything. You can't get a container ship. You can't get a truck to pick it up from the port. You can't get a truck to send it to FedEx. And FedEx doesn't have enough trucks to deliver it. And FedEx doesn't have enough drivers to deliver it, right? You never had that. You never had all of that that you had to worry about in logistics. That was the massive kind of like COVID strain during logistics that everybody heard about. And then everybody you knew became a supply chain expert, right? On my social media, it was the first time I ever saw people do screenshots of tracking. You know, of their FedEx package and being like, why did this go 100 miles away from where I am? You know, why did it go from Los Angeles to Sacramento to Los Angeles? Why did that happen? Right. And everybody became very interested in that. So during COVID, obviously the cost went up a lot and it became, you really had to manage the network much more aggressively than you did before. You had to become, so at FabFitFun, in order to successfully execute, I had to become more of an expert on the carrier's network than the carrier was themselves, at least our salesperson. And I'll give you an example of that. After we got burned the first winter of COVID, we set up reports and dashboards that would tell us not only when parcels had been picked up, but when the parcels had been inducted into the carrier's network. So if FedEx picked up a truck from us, whereas pre-COVID, all you had to worry about was whether FedEx picked up the truck and you never thought about it, minus maybe, you know, one lost package you'd have to worry about, which always happens. Mm-hmm. Now you had to worry about when did FedEx or the carrier induct that into their network? You never had to worry about that before.
Right.
So we built reports that told us when these parcels were being inducted into the network. And I would be monitoring my reports every day. And I would be able to tell, did they misplace a trailer or are they backed up? And there were ways from the reports that I could tell whether just a trailer was misplaced or whether they're backed up by 20 trailers. And I would call the carriers. I would call the carriers and say, and we did it by hub. So we weren't just shipping to one hub. So for example, we worked with an East Coast regional carrier. We were shipping to three of their hubs, not just one. So I would call them up and I would say, you have a problem at your New Jersey facility. And they say, oh, I haven't heard that. I'm like, make some phone calls. And they would call me back and they'd be like, yeah, yeah, we have trailers parked on the street. I'm like, I know you do. I know you do because we're one of your biggest shippers. And I can see that normally all your trailers are inducted after 5 days. And this is 8 days later. And I have trailers that aren't inducted yet into your system. So that's what it was like managing parcel during COVID. Now, post-COVID is very interesting because obviously e-commerce is not as strong as it was during COVID.
Right.
And people are going to stores more and people are just spending less or they're spending more on different things, right? They're going on vacation versus buying whatever the hell they could online. So it's different now because during COVID, the carriers had about 95% of the leverage. Now the carriers like FedEx, LaserShip, OnTrack don't have as much of the leverage, but they have inflationary pressures. So it's not just because the shippers like me have the leverage now doesn't mean we can go back to the old world. Like that $5 box that I negotiated at FabFitFun, Steve, it's never coming back.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? It's never coming back.
Right.
That world is never coming back. And I feel like folks do in a whole host of ways, not just about logistics, but about life in general, haven't fully accepted that a lot of the pre-COVID world is not coming back. It's a new world. Yeah. And so in logistics, it's a new world too. So whereas pre-COVID, my job, if I did my job effectively, My job is basically to bleed the carrier as much as I can. And I don't really care how much margin they make on that package or if they make any margin at all.
Right.
I don't care. Not my job. Now, right. You do have to worry about that. Because if you put your cap, because of cost pressures, labor, things like that, if you put your carrier in a place where you've somehow managed to get them to agree to a cost that's below what they should, below their cost, it's not sustainable.
Right.
So something about that relationship later is going to break. You might get a short-term win.
Right.
And if you have 10 carriers and you want to get a short-term win from one and bleed one out, but you have 9 other carriers to go to, maybe that's a little bit morally bankrupt, but be my guest, right? Your carrier network is not, your carrier network is going to survive that, right?
Yeah.
But if you only have 1 or 2, you can't do that because eventually something's going to give, something's going to break. They're going to come back to you and they're going to say, I can't do this. You have to find another carrier or I'm raising your rates by $2 a package. Something like that's going to happen. Whereas pre-COVID, that was inconceivable, right? That was never going to happen. So that's kind of the differences in the ways that you manage for e-commerce or anything in general, but parcel logistics is mostly e-commerce in this country now. That's how you mostly manage it for pre-COVID, during COVID, and post-COVID. I'm definitely in a much better position. I have much more leverage now, but I have to consider other factors that I didn't have to pre-COVID. Pre-COVID, it was just so much easier. And you knew, you know, I ran a warehouse pre-COVID too when I worked for Vans, the sneaker company that's owned by VS. We had an engineer that came in and made us models for our peak seasons, which were back to school and which were a holiday, not just for e-commerce, but also the Vans retail stores and the wholesale. I took that model. I just added 3% every year. And that was my model for the next year. And that's how I ran the warehouse operations for 3 years. Steve, do you think people can do that today?
No.
I don't think people can do that today. Mm-mm. Again, that's not the world we live in. You cannot just take the same model that an engineer made for you 3 or 4 times, not necessarily understand how it works, but just know that where the little cell is, where you have to write percentage of growth, put 3 or 4 and you're done. Doesn't work.
Yeah. That's great. Thanks for sharing all that because you have so much context from both like pre, during, and post. My next question is around the post-COVID era that we're in now. And it's multi-channel is a word that all brands are expanding out in. We think like, you know, social, we think of like marketplaces, we think of B2B, we think of internationalization and expanding. And the people listening today are like in that space right now. They're like, hey, we have our Shopify store, so to speak. And, you know, we're selling direct to consumer. We do the odd pop-up shop, or we might be selling wholesale to these people. And so what's your mindset from a logistics perspective? Like how are brands supposed to manage? Are people in your position? How do you think about all of these channels where product is being sold? And is it a good business decision to do that, to expand it wide? And then what happens if you expand too wide too quickly, especially from an internationalization perspective? But just curious on the social marketplaces, the Amazons, and then the B2B side. Just want to hear your mindset around all of this.
Yeah, I think what was really interesting is that a lot of digitally native brands decided that they wanted to go into brick and mortar, right?
Yeah.
So they make this evolution where they are only online and claim that that's the future. And then they realize, okay, well, we need some sort of brick and mortar presence, maybe not to sell our product, but at least for marketing or what people call activations.
Yeah.
And things
like
that. I
think Allbirds did that. I think Allbirds has retail like this.
Yes. Casper did. I live in Los Angeles, very close to West Hollywood and Melrose Avenue and Beverly Boulevard and The Grove and the Beverly Center and places like that. So that's where people do these things, right?
Right.
So yeah. Away had a luggage shop, which was actually, I was living so close to the FabFitFun office that I would walk there because that was also in West Hollywood. And the Away store was on the way. And one day my bag broke. So I just jumped in the Away store and bought a bag.
Yeah.
So, you know, which is probably not how most people buy their Away luggage, right? Or their Away bags.
Right.
So I think people were thinking that we need this for marketing purposes, but then they also realized, no, we actually need to be in stores. You know, brick and mortar might be dying, but it's not dying fast enough for everybody to just buy everything online. And there are things that people want to go see in person, touch in person, have that experience.
Right.
So it's one of those things that doesn't just happen in e-commerce, but it happens everywhere where for the mundane things or repeat ordering, or once you've captured a customer, maybe online is okay. You know, if I know what retinol cream I want, I don't need to go to the store to get that retinol cream. That is not a value add in my life. But if I want some advice, or I have a specific concern, or I want to investigate new brands, or something cool is happening, then, you know, you want to go to a brick and mortar place. So it's interesting you had all these digitally native e-commerce brands decide, first of all, we need physical presence for like marketing and awareness purposes. And then we actually want brick and mortar for the purposes of selling. So I was at Bala Bangles for about 6 months in between FabFitFun at Mura and Murad, and they were going into Target. They were going into QVC. Like, those are not necessarily the most cutting edge places to be selling your product, right? But that's where the people are. So you need to go where the people are. In terms of an international perspective, I think particularly in skincare, what is challenging is that you have certain requirements in international markets, and you need to tailor that product with those requirements. But then you come across issues like minimum quantity. And it's like, you know, if your minimum quantity to run something is 10,000, but your market is only 3,000, and you can only sell that particular product in that particular market, how'd you manage that?
Right.
It's very hard. It's a lot of really hard decisions until you scale up to the point where you don't have an issue meeting minimum quantity. So these are questions that brands have to ask themselves. Of course, you know, it's a more important question when you're somewhere at Murad that has a lot of, you know, regulations they need to follow or needs to understand them. It's a little bit different when you're making a Bala Bangle or you're making a Van Shu, where of course no one wants to make more inventory than they need, but that inventory is not going to go bad, right? It doesn't literally go bad. It may go unfashionable. Someone will still wear that shoe, but it doesn't literally, the shoe itself doesn't fall apart because, you know, it sat there for six more months than it was supposed to.
Right. What about sustainability and kind of this eco-friendly kind of mentality that's out now? I mean, I've interviewed lots of brands that say, hey, our unboxing experience is really important to us. And one of our brand ethos is X, something that we do about our packaging. You made a good comment too about taking the air out of some things so that it's easier and have a smaller kind of more dimensionally correct, lower price point to ship it because it's smaller. So I just want to hear your mindset around sustainability as a brand lever for growth or any eco-friendliness. What are you seeing in the logistics world now?
Yeah, I could talk about two examples, one from FabFitFun, one from Murad, and then one example that I think is very funny because people believe that they're being eco-friendly, but they're actually not. And this is where a lot of sometimes consumers, not companies, consumers believe that something is eco-friendly and it's not, and they actually put you in a different situation. So when we were at FabFitFun before COVID, so this is another great pre-COVID difference. At FabFitFun, our dimensional divisor was very high. Mm-hmm. So there was no way we were creating a box that was so big that we would have to pay a dimensional weight versus physical
the
weight.
Real weight, yeah.
Right. And for your listeners who don't know, a dimensional weight is a weight that you get charged because basically something is too big and it's too bulky. So you never want to be charged dimensional weight. There's always usually going to be a higher charge than the actual physical weight of your product. But because I did such a good job negotiating that previous contract, our dim factor was not an issue. But then we started having an issue with the parcels would fill up too many trucks. So FedEx came, like, so when I told you before, if you had to call FedEx for a truck, did you ever have to worry about whether the truck was going to come? You know, in 2019, you didn't. In 2020, you did. So FedEx came to us at some point and said, hey, you don't get unlimited trucks anymore. You get 15 trucks a day. We're like, well, we need 20 trucks a day. So what are we going to do? FedEx doesn't care. They've told us it's 15 trucks a day, take it or leave it, right? Find somebody else to take your five other trucks. So what we did is we started figuring out ways to make our box, not necessarily make our box smaller, but FabFitFun has its subscription box, and then it has a separate e-commerce sale, and they go on at the same time. Previously, if you bought a subscription box and bought something from the e-commerce sale, the subscription box would go into a bigger box. Mm. What we did at FabFitFun, and this was mostly headed by Julian Van Erlach, who I had mentioned before at FabFitFun, what we had done is we developed a technology and a system so that the system would understand whether or not that additional e-commerce item could go into the subscription box, which was something that wasn't done before because we just didn't have to do it, right? There was no economical push. Right. So it was primarily in order to reduce the number of trucks that we send, not necessarily primarily for the environmental impact, but that had a bigger environmental impact than anything that we may have done randomly for an environmental impact. Mm. On the flip side of that, with the subscription box, that's so funny, and this is the point where people think they're being eco-friendly and they're not, is that we would overproduce subscription boxes sometimes, right? Unfortunately, you think you're going to have 2 million members, but you actually have 1.9 million. You actually didn't do a bad job. You forecasted by 95%, right? Most people would think that's a good job. You're still left with 100,000 boxes. Right. So sometimes we would put something small in that box in order to use it and send it out. And then we would get complaints. And people would say, I can't believe you're using a box so big for this eyeliner or this moisturizer. Mm-hmm. But the consumer sees that. I understand why the consumer thinks what they think. They're not insane, right? But they don't understand that me going out, buying, producing a smaller box to put your eyeliner is actually less eco-friendly than me using the box that's already produced. And that's an interesting phenomenon where everybody thinks they're like, no, you need to use a smaller box. I'm like, yes, I agree with you. In theory, in an ideal world where we forecast our box production 100%, 100% of the time, we would have a smaller box than we would put that in. But in the world we live in, we know even if at 2 million members, you're 95% good at your forecast, you're going to have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of boxes left that have accumulated over the different seasons. Using those boxes is always going to be more eco-friendly than making a new box, but you lose the battle because folks don't really understand that. They just want to see a smaller box. That's not more eco-friendly. That's not more sustainable. You're producing more.
Right. Yeah. No, I totally get it. I think you're spot on. And I've also learned some trends too, what some brands are doing is they're going into poly mailers now. They feel that they've negotiated a better rate instead of having, you're using trees and, you know, trying to get as eco-friendly as possible. They're doing some kind of a poly mail. I don't even know if that's even eco-friendly, but I think
I don't even know if that's recyclable. I don't know.
I don't know. Exactly. But you see that trend more. And I see a lot of packages coming in. I think even like I had some Mack Weldon just show up recently and they're in some kind of a poly mailer and they have some inserts and they're kind of doing their thing. And it's such an interesting market. You know, it's exciting. Yeah. And there's so many angles to the savings that come out of it. And I exactly hear what you're saying. It's really hard to sell the market on that fact that using a larger box instead of ordering more, because you can't educate people one by one by one is the reasons why you're doing it. Because I think there's going to be a lot of people that are just irritated about the fact that the eyeliner was sent in a larger box and they didn't complain about it. So I think there's another side to it of like the non-complaining. You know, there's a book out there, you know, happy people tell like three friends and, you know, disgruntled one, you know, tells 3,000 kind of thing, right?
So. Yeah, well, and it's funny that you say that because I agree, because I feel that especially during COVID, the role of a logistics leader is to stop everybody else in the organization from overreacting to issues in logistics.
Yeah.
So I remember at one time, you know, one of the top executives at FabFitFun sent me a Twitter post showing that, you know, there were all these packages. I think a train car had been broken into, a FedEx train car, and all these packages were strewn all over the tracks. And he's like, oh my God, do we stop using FedEx? I'm like, no, that's not the answer. Like, stop using FedEx. Oh my goodness. And this was my quote in the Wall Street Journal in the article they interviewed me for, is that during COVID, when you know you could barely get delivery drivers, someone would show up in a 1985 beat up car in shorts, a tank top and flip-flops to deliver your package. And people would complain that it was so unprofessional and it didn't look right. I'm like, well, I'm sorry, but this is COVID. We have a historic labor shortage. So it's either that person is delivering your package or no one is delivering your package. and these were the things you needed to let people know about, is that this is the best we can do, right? That person is the best you can do. And now that the parcel market has calmed down a little bit, obviously the people that you see delivering your packages were quite professional, but whoever was going to deliver that package was going to be who delivered that package.
Right. Yeah. It's like Uber right now, like Uber Eats or DoorDash or whatever, the different kind of delivery. The professionalism is just, unfortunately, even today is not there anymore, other than maybe the physical package that maybe if they have to keep it hot or cold, maybe there's that branded thing as they show up to your door. But other than that, Yeah, that last mile delivery is another whole conversation for another podcast. Well, this is great. Andreas, I got a couple pages of notes here. This has been really educational for me. It's nice to kind of get the inside scoop because I usually typically talk to people in the kind of app space and the marketing space and kind of maybe the agency space actually building. And it's nice to see like this. The area that you're in is very interesting. I think it's an unserved kind of market, so to speak, about like from an education perspective, because I think it's really important for leaders to kind of understand the importance of people like you in your role and kind of and how impactful you can be on the brand journey. And there's so many moving parts. It's the same as like net new customers and on a marketing side and brand building and all that. I get all that, but yours is an important lever. And I just wanted to thank you for being like transparent and kind of sharing a lot of this stuff. For those listening, if they want to learn more about you individually or kind of your history, or I just kind of want to know what like, you should just go to LinkedIn. They can kind of friend you there and kind of follow
yes,
your journey.
LinkedIn is probably the best. I'm more than always happy to talk about these things with people.
Okay.
People think I'm a little bit too passionate about this stuff. So if you're also passionate and want to have discussions, I love discussing things.
Cool.
I try to make it to a few trade shows every year. I'm not active on Twitter because if I was, well, most of my friends would probably stop being friends with me. It would probably be insufferable. But
okay.
anybody can find me on LinkedIn.
Okay, lovely. I'll have that in the show notes. Once again, thank you so much for taking time and recording today. That has been really impactful and I just really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Well, that's it for today's episode. I'd like to thank you personally for being a loyal listener of E-commerce Fastlane. It's my hope that this podcast is offering you a ton of value through growth strategies, tactics, and exclusive insider tips on the best Shopify apps and marketing platforms, all with my personal goal to help you build, manage, grow, and scale a successful and thriving company powered by Shopify. Thanks for investing some time today and listening to the show. I'm so proud and excited that you have a growth mindset and are a constant learner. I truly appreciate you and your entrepreneurial journey. Enjoy the rest of the week and keep thriving with Shopify.